Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation and International and National Security Law Practice Groups, was recorded on Tuesday, March 24, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call and our discussion of the Texas Federal District Court immigration decision. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two experts to our call today. We're going to hear opening remarks from each in turn, and then, as always, we'll be turning to the audience for questions, so please do be thinking of your questions when we get to that part of the program. We're going to hear opening remarks of about 10 to 15 minutes each, first from Breanne Gorod. She's the appellate counsel at the Constitutional Accountability Center. In addition to making her initial opening statement, she's going to begin by giving us some background remarks. We'll hear then from Professor John C. Eastman. He's director of the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence and the Henry Salvatore Professor of Law and Community Service at Chapman University Dale E. Fowler School of Law. And with that, let's begin with our opening remarks. Please go right ahead, Breanne Gorod.
Well, thank you, Dean, and thank you to the Federal Society for hosting this teleforum and for inviting me to participate. As Dean said, I'll start by providing just a little background on the President's executive action and this litigation. So back in November of last year, the Department of Homeland Security issued memoranda that, among other things, stated that our nation's enforcement and removal priorities should be national security, border security, and public safety. And that in light of those priorities and given limited enforcement resources, federal immigration officials should exercise discretion on a case-by-case basis to defer removal of certain parents of U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents. This program was called DAPA. And the directives also broadened eligibility criteria for an earlier deferred action program called DACA for certain aliens that were brought to the United States as children. So in response to the issuance of these memoranda, roughly two dozen states sued. They alleged that these directives violated both the Constitution's Take Care Clause, which provides that the President, quote, shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed, unquote, and the Administrative Procedure Act's requirement that rules be promulgated following notice and comment procedure. So the government both challenged the state standing to sue and also obviously contested their claims on the merits. And on February 16th, the district court out of Texas issued an opinion. The court held that Texas had standing to sue. It didn't resolve standing as to the other states. And it preliminarily enjoined the implementation of DAPA as well as the expansion to DACA nationwide, so across the country. The district court premised its injunction on the government's failure to comply with the APA's notice and comment procedure, but it's worth noting there was significant rhetoric in the opinion that suggested that the district court judge thought the program also exceeded the president's executive authority. The government initially sought a stay from the district court, but after that court issued an order announcing that it wouldn't act on the stay request until after a hearing scheduled for last week on a separate issue, the government moved on to the Fifth Circuit. It sought a stay from that court and also filed a motion for an expedited briefing schedule of the appeal. That schedule would have oral arguments set for June. So the plaintiff states filed their response to the stay motion in the Fifth Circuit yesterday, and so I think we'll likely expect to hear from the Fifth Circuit on both of these motions fairly soon. So that's the background. Now, before delving into the specific arguments at issue in this litigation, I just want to start with a little history and a very important first principle that I think follows from that history. So when it comes to this immigration executive action, as well as other executive actions that President Obama has taken, those who oppose him often point to our founding era history and the framers' opposition to monarchical rule. And it's certainly true, the framers didn't want a king. That's obviously why they cut ties with Great Britain. But I think this accounting of the history misses an important part of the story, and that's that their relationship with England wasn't the only thing that shaped the drafting of the Constitution. The framers were also very much shaped by their experience under the Articles of Confederation, the precursor to the Constitution. The Articles lasted just 8 years, And one of the central weaknesses contributing to its demise was that it lacked an executive branch capable of enforcing the nation's laws. So when our framers drafted the Constitution, they created a strong executive branch headed by a single president. And this new president was given a number of express powers and responsibilities, including the obligation to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And they wanted presidents who would energetically fulfill that responsibility. Alexander Hamilton may have put it best when he said that all men of sense will agree in the necessity of an energetic executive. So what does this mean? Well, one longstanding manifestation of the responsibility to take care that the laws be faithfully executed is the ability to determine how best to enforce the law. Then Justice William Rehnquist wrote for the Supreme Court nearly 30 years ago in a case called Heckler v. Cheney, an agency's decision not to prosecute or enforce a law is a decision generally committed to an agency's absolute discretion. And he explained why this is. It's often the case that the executive branch is particularly well positioned to make decisions about enforcement. It's better equipped, he said, than the courts to deal with the many variables involved in the proper ordering of the agency's priorities. That includes whether a particular enforcement action fits the agency's overall policies, and he also noted whether the agency has enough resources to undertake the action at all. And so what this means is that the executive branch generally enjoys the discretion to determine how the nation's laws can best be enforced, including what the nation's enforcement priorities should be, unless Congress explicitly prohibits the exercise of such discretion. It is certainly true that the executive branch can't, as a general matter, as Heckler said this, consciously and expressly adopt a general policy that is so extreme as to amount to an abdication of its statutory responsibilities. But that limitation still leaves significant room for the executive branch to set enforcement priorities and to exercise discretion in determining how best to implement those priorities. And what that means is that this executive branch, all executive branches, are daily making decisions about how best to enforce the law. And so turning to immigration, this exercise of discretion is particularly important. The Supreme Court has noted this repeatedly. It's noted that immigration law is a field in which, quote, flexibility and the adaptation of the congressional policy to infinitely variable conditions, unquote, is essential. It's also a field that is vitally and intricately interwoven with the conduct of foreign relations, a field that is particularly within the president's expertise. So reflecting these considerations, Congress has repeatedly conferred authority on executive branch officials to exercise discretion in enforcing the nation's immigration laws. For example, in the Immigration and Nationality Act, Congress authorized the Secretary of Homeland Security to establish such regulations, to issue instructions, and to perform other acts he deems necessary for carrying out his authority under the statute. In the Homeland Security Act of 2002, Congress directed the Secretary to establish national immigration enforcement policies and priorities. So the consequence of these delegations is to give tremendous authority to the President to set immigration policy, as the Supreme Court has recognized. As recently as 2012 in Arizona v. United States, the court noted that a principal feature of the removal system is the broad discretion exercised by immigration officials. The court noted that federal officials, as an initial matter, must decide whether it makes sense to pursue removal at all. And in fact, importantly here, the executive branch has no choice but to make such removal decisions because of decisions Congress has made. There are roughly 11.3 million undocumented immigrants in this country, and Congress has only provided funding to cover roughly 400,000 removals per year. That means that the executive branch necessarily must make decisions about enforcement priorities and how best to implement those priorities in enforcing the law. And so, turning to this litigation in particular and the directives the administration issued in November, that is all the administration has done. These directives make very clear they were issued to articulate the federal government's priorities in immigration enforcement and to provide guidance to officers in the field about how to exercise case-by-case discretion in a manner that's consistent with those priorities. They explain, as I noted at the outset, explicitly that DHS's priorities in enforcement are national security, border security, and public safety, and that DAPA, the case-by-case use of deferred action, is an exercise of those priorities. So this is a classic exercise of executive branch discretion, of prosecutorial discretion, as it's often called. The executive branch has set out enforcement priorities, it's worth noting, that are entirely consistent with the laws that Congress has passed, and it's provided guidance to facilitate the case-by-case exercise of discretion to implement those policies. Now, as I noted at the outset, the states argue that these directives violate both the Take Care Clause and the APA. But the fact that these directives are paradigmatic exercises of prosecutorial discretion is really fatal to both claims. Starting with the Take Care claim, the states argue that these directives violate the Constitution because, they say, claims of prosecutorial discretion don't afford the executive a blank check to dispense with the law. And that's surely true, but it's simply irrelevant here because, as the directives make clear, they don't dispense with the law at all. The administration is continuing to enforce the law. It's continuing to engage in removals. But it's simply decided that, given limited resources, rather than simply deport the first 400,000 undocumented immigrants it can identify, resources should be dedicated, and this is a quote from one of the memoranda, to the greatest degree possible to the removal of aliens described in the priorities, again, those that threaten national security, public safety, and border security. The directives, in fact, specifically state that nothing in the memoranda should be construed to prohibit or discourage the removal of aliens unlawfully in the United States who aren't identified in the priorities. Now, the DHS directives comply with the Administrative Procedure Act for essentially the same reasons. The APA requires notice and comment procedures for most rules, but it generally exempts from that requirement general statements of policy, and that's exactly what these are. Now, the district court concluded that they didn't qualify for this exemption because, in their view, they established a binding norm. They were, in effect, a new law that created a new right to be legally present in the United States. But again, this misunderstands what these directives do. They simply articulate the nation's immigration enforcement priorities and provide guidance to ensure that these priorities are honored as officials exercise discretion in the field. So looking at the district court's opinion, it seems at times that what was really bothering the court was that the executive branch announced these directives as a formal and explicit policy rather than simply deferring removals on a case-by-case basis without announcing that this is going to happen. Put a little differently, the judge seems to be suggesting that the executive action is simply the president's attempt to make law where Congress failed to do so. And that's why it's really important to emphasize that the president in these directives wasn't making law without Congress. He can't do that. He's acknowledged that repeatedly. And executive action isn't the same thing as a law passed by Congress, most significantly because it can be undone at any time by this president or by a subsequent one in a way that a law passed by Congress couldn't be. Indeed, the memos are quite explicit on that point. They make clear they confer no substantive right, no immigration status, and no pathway to citizenship. And they note that they can be terminated at any time at the agency's discretion. Moreover, there's no reason to think that the articulation of these guidelines, putting them out in writing, is more problematic than their exercise. In fact, articulating these policies really secures greater transparency. It makes clear what the executive branch's priorities are, how they think they should be implemented, and it provides immigration officials and officers in the field with clear guidance while also being allowed flexibility. So in this way, they actually promote the values underlying the rule of law. So to view these directives as creating some new right or as an affirmative act, as the court also said, simply misunderstands that the executive branch is always making decisions about enforcement. That's required by the Constitution, and it's required by the laws Congress has passed, and that, again, is all these directives are doing, reflecting executive branch determinations about how best to enforce the nation's immigration laws in light of national priorities and limited enforcement resources. So I think the district court was clearly wrong to have concluded otherwise, and I feel confident this decision will be reversed on appeal. So I'll turn it over now to John. I look forward to hearing his remarks.
Thank you very much. As you might guess, I disagree on just about every point. let me add one bit in my introduction. The Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, which I direct, is at the Claremont Institute, and I didn't want to overlook their generous support of our litigation efforts. And this, we have not weighed in yet in this case, but I fully expect that we will be at some point. So let me take each of these points. The notion that this is just normal application of discretion in prosecutorial enforcement by the president, and that therefore the court was wrong in assuming otherwise. That's not what's going on here. And you know, the memo by the Department of Homeland Security, issued initially by Secretary Napolitano, and then the back in 2012, and then the subsequent memos issued by Jay Johnson in November of 2014, all parrot the language case-by-case discretion, because they understand that's required in the exercise of prosecutorial discretion. If you unilaterally change and exclude or exempt from prosecution or enforcement of the law an entire category of people according to eligibility criteria that you set out, you're not just choosing on a case-by-case basis to exercise discretion. You are rewriting the law. And that's clearly what's gone on here. The memo says repeatedly that it's case-by-case discretion, but the language is full of things like what the line officers in the immigration services should do, must do. They shall do this. They shall stop any even investigation of anybody meeting these criteria. Indeed, the folks that are on the receiving end of this presidential directive actually believe that if they meet the criteria, they have an eligibility to remain here in the United States, not just to be low on the priority for removal and prosecution, but actually to be entitled to stay lawfully in the United States. And the executive's actions, both at the Department of Justice and at the Department of Homeland Security, have confirmed that that's exactly the message they intended to give. The Supreme Court is very clear on this, that's what crosses the line. As Brianna noted, the Heckler case that sets out the president's prosecutorial discretion specifically says that you can't categorically change the law or change the rules on eligibility without moving from exercise of prosecutorial discretion to undermining the taxpayer obligation that the laws be faithfully executed. That's not the only case that has addressed this. Kendall versus United States back in 1838. To contend that the obligation imposed on the president to see the laws faithfully executed implies a power to forbid their execution is a novel construction of the Constitution, to say the least, and entirely inadmissible. Here's another one. The Office of Legal Counsel's memo supporting this or purporting to support this action recognizes the executive branch ordinarily cannot consciously and expressly adopt a general policy that is so extreme as to amount to an abdication of its statutory duties. A general policy of non-enforcement that forecloses the exercise of case-by-case discretion poses special risk that the agency has exceeded the bounds of its enforcement discretion. Those are the kind of things that set where the line is between valid prosecutorial discretion and invalid rewriting or suspension of the laws, and that's clearly what's gone on here. And in case any line officer of the Immigration Services missed it, the president a few weeks ago gave a speech specifically saying, when we give you guidelines, you damn well better enforce them, or you know, there's going to be trouble in your continuing employment in the agencies. So this is not a set of guidelines for case-by-case analysis by the line officers. This is redefining who's eligible to remain in this country lawfully. Now, the second piece of this is, even if you accept that this massive rewriting of the eligibility criteria is a valid exercise of prosecutorial discretion, these actions go much further than that by taking that prosecutorial discretion, not just declining to put somebody into removal proceedings, but actually giving them certifications that allow them to stay here, giving them work authorizations, which entitles them to Social Security cards and benefits, entitles them to file tax returns, to get refunds of taxes they haven't even paid under the earned income tax credit, and to do that retroactively for 3 years. This is billions of dollars in monies that will now be going out to illegal immigrants that were never authorized by Congress. This is what Texas has complained about in the lawsuit, joined by 26 states, that has given them standing to challenge the president's orders, because all of these collateral benefits that will flow from this exercise of so-called prosecutorial discretion are going to impose massive costs in the states. And I think Judge Hainan, in his 123-page opinion, devotes a significant portion of that opinion to addressing the standing issue, and I think he's absolutely right here. So we've got this question. And by the way, I'm not alone in believing that the president has exceeded his authorities here. On 22 different occasions, the president himself, before he did this, said in public that he had no constitutional authority to do exactly what he has now done. Now, maybe that was campaign rhetoric, or maybe he's not the constitutional lawyer that he's always claimed to be. And, you know, one of the arguments I've seen that, well, he didn't know that he actually could do it. So his lawyers told him he could, and he agreed with that. That's silly. The president had no authority to do this. He did not get the action through Congress that he wanted, and so he unilaterally changed the law, provided – now Brianna is right about one thing. A future president can unravel this and then ramp up removal proceedings and deportations. But imagine the consequences of trying to – will that president be able to recover the earned income tax credits that have been paid, to cancel the work authorizations, to remove or confiscate the driver's licenses? This is one of those things that once you've done it, it's hard to unravel, and the president understands that, and that's why he's done it. It's patently unconstitutional. Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution begins that the lawmaking powers herein delegated are vested in a Congress of the United States. It doesn't say in a Congress unless they don't act in the way the president wants, and then the president can do it unilaterally. It says in a Congress of the United States. And there is nothing in the entire statutory scheme that this Congress has adopted, that has been signed into law by previous presidents, that authorizes this kind of unfettered discretion, not just not to put people into removal proceedings, but to actually give a lawful presence, a lawful status of sorts, to the individuals that are that the president has determined not to be removing. And let me draw a comparison. The normal prosecutorial discretion, let's take our something as simple as our speed limits on our highways. You've got a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, and I'll venture to guess that a lot of people at this very moment are exceeding that speed limit. Some of them might even be doing so, passing by police officers sitting by the side of the road. If they are going a relatively modest amount over the speed limit, the police officer on the ground exercises prosecutorial discretion on a case-by-case basis and says, I'm not going to pull that person over. If somebody's blowing through here 20 miles over the speed limit, I'm going to pull that person over. That's quintessential case-by-case prosecutorial discretion. But if I now say, if you're only going 7 or 10 miles over the speed limit, and you have a blue car that was made in the last 7 years, and that makes you eligible not to get pulled over that police officer, we have now changed the law. We're not exercising prosecutorial discretion. And to hand that person a certification that you are entitled to go 10 miles over the law gives you a lawful status, a lawful situation that the statute clearly does not authorize. That goes beyond prosecutorial discretion, and it's an exercise of lawmaking that the president unilaterally does not have. And yet he has claimed such power here. And more importantly, when Congress has tried to respond to it by refusing to fund this unlawful action, the members of the Senate in his own party have joined forces with him to block any attempt to constrain the unauthorized and unconstitutional actions of this president. That's a very dangerous thing. It's a real threat to our separation of powers. And quite frankly, anything that Congress can do at this point to join in the efforts to curtail this illegal action by the president is going to be very important for the long-term vitality of our separation of powers. Recently, there was a suggestion made that the Senate ought to block any judicial nominee from this president for the next 2 years until he quits exercising this illegal claim of authority here. That's a real threat to our constitutional system. I fully applaud that effort, as I do the effort of Texas, which I'm happy to say is being headed up by the Solicitor General of Texas, a former Lincoln Fellow at our own Claremont Institute, or Marshall Fellow, I'm sorry, at our Claremont Institute here. We're very pleased with the efforts that they're doing. We think they're spot on, that the states have significant collateral impact damages because of the imposed costs, the costs that are going to be imposed on them by these actions. That gives them standing to challenge whether the president's orders here, they're not even executive orders, they're just implementing memos of what they're doing, and they have radically changed the dynamics of the law that Congress set out. Now, the president, and in fact many Republicans and Democrats in Congress, think that our law on immigration needs to be changed, but the way the Constitution sets out to change it is by passage in both houses of Congress, the House and the Senate, bicameralism, presentment to the president for signature, or if he vetoes it, for an override of that veto. That's the way we change the laws. We don't just unilaterally rewrite them in a memo from the Secretary of Homeland Security to the line officers in the Immigration Services. That's not constitutionalism. That's really lawlessness. And quite frankly, I applaud Judge Hainan's courageous decision here. I fully expect that it will be upheld by the Fifth Circuit and, quite frankly, by the Supreme Court of the United States when it gets there as well.
Well, thank you very much. We've got a lot on the table. I should have mentioned at the outset, let me mention now, that this is an abbreviated version of our Teleform conference call. We'll adjourn this call at either quarter of or maybe 10 of. We can go probably as late as 10 of the hour. We've got quite a few people on the line. I want to give Brianne Gorod a chance to respond at least a little bit. But first, before we do that, let's open the floor to questions so people can begin queuing up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that announcement, if you have a question, you push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to the audience questions, let me do two things. I'm going to make a quick announcement about some of our upcoming calls. Tomorrow at 2 p.m., we'll be discussing political contribution limits, labor unions, and businesses. It's tomorrow, 2 p.m. Eastern Time. On Thursday, our teleform will focus on the Environmental Protection Agency back in the Supreme Court, the Michigan versus EPA case. That is Thursday at 3 p.m. And then on Friday, we'll be looking at the new NLRB representation case rule at 1 p.m. Friday. Today, of course, the immigration decision. Let me give Brianne Gorod a minute or two to respond. And in your response, maybe if you can help the audience understand, did the court actually reach the sort of constitutional executive powers question? Was it just an APA decision? And what does that mean for a decision by the Fifth Circuit and ultimately the Supreme Court? Are they going to delve into the larger constitutional issues?
Sure. So the district court did not resolve the constitutional issue, although there was lots of rhetoric in its opinion which suggested that it was sympathetic to the state's argument, but it only actually held on the APA issue. I think, you know, it's likely that both of these issues will continue to be briefed and will be addressed as the case moves up on appeal. Just to respond quickly to a couple of the comments that John made, I think it's just not right to say that this is not an exercise of discretion. To take his speeder hypothetical, I don't think anyone would find it objectionable if the police department had guidance for its officers in the field saying, yes, all speeders may be violating the law, but you should really focus your efforts on those who are going 20 miles above the speed limit or those who are otherwise driving erratically. Those are our priorities because those are dangers to others on the road. And so, use your discretion, but those are where your priority should be. And that's essentially what these memoranda do. I mean, they're very clear on that point. And they say explicitly that officers on the field, can order the removal of any covered alien if it would serve an important federal interest. Now, John said they're just parroting the language they think they need to parrot, but there's really no reason to say that. I mean, critically, the program's not even operating yet, so there's really no reason to say this is how it is or will operate on the field. We just don't know that, and I think it was, frankly, quite wrong of the district court to suggest otherwise. Its assertion that 100% of these applications would be approved was just utter speculation. Tellingly, DACA, the 2012 program, which is not challenged, has been operating, and it has been operating with the officials on the ground exercising discretion. A non-trivial number of applications have been rejected, and so there's every reason to think that this program will operate that way as well. Officers exercising case-by-case discretion, but facilitating the, national priorities that the department has articulated consistent with the laws that Congress has passed. And then just to address quickly the work authorization point, it's true, as John said, that, once DAPA is implemented, employers will be able to hire undocumented immigrants for whom removal has been deferred. But contrary to the district court's conclusion, this is not because of the directives that the Obama administration issued in November. This result follows from pre-existing laws and regulations. Specifically, Congress has conferred discretion on the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security to allow employers to hire non-permanent resident aliens whom would otherwise be unlawful to hire in certain circumstances. As the Office of Legal Counsel explained in its opinion on these directives, this ability to apply for work authorization doesn't depend on background principles of agency discretion. Rather, it depends on independent and more specific statutory authority rooted in the text of the INA. And then just very quickly on standing, it's worth noting that while Texas says it will be injured by implementation of these directives, the district court premised standing exclusively on the fact that Texas would be issuing driver's licenses to folks who qualify under the DAPA program. Roughly a dozen other states have said that actually there'll be lots of economic benefits will accrue if these executive actions are implemented. And I think it's, you know, it'll be interesting to see what both the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, if it gets there, do on standing. You know, as a general matter, I'm very much in favor of robust judicial review, but I think the government has made really strong arguments on standing in this case, given existing Supreme Court precedent. And then finally, John obviously spoke a lot about the president's comments about his authority, but I think what really matters here is not what the president has said, but what our court's precedents say and what the Constitution says and what the laws of Congress say. And I think under all of those, it's very clear that these are paradigmatic exercise of discretion and are fully consistent with both the Take Care Clause and the APA for that reason.
John Eastman, let me give you 60 seconds.
Sure. So, again, on every one of those points, I disagree. The program is operating. One of the things that happened last week is the court had to confront the issue of the Department of Justice lawyers lying to the court about the implementation of this program, which was already underway, contrary to the representations to the court. And more than 100,000 extensions of the DACA authorization, which are part of the November 2014 program, were already being done contrary to those representations. Second piece, that there's a non-trivial number of people under DACA that were not given the deferred action status. Well, that's true, but it's not because there was any exercise of discretion. It's because they didn't meet one of the criteria. And when one of my opposing witnesses at the Senate hearing back in December was asked this very question, how many people that meet the criteria were denied the deferred action, the answer was none to his knowledge, and nobody else has identified any either. So that means this is not a case by case. The only case by case analysis that's going on is, do you meet the criteria we've set out? Once you do, you're treated as entitled to that deferred action, and that means we've rewritten the law. We're not just exercising case by case discretion. These are the stakes of what's going on, and quite frankly, it's millions of people. And the notion that Texas might not have to give out the driver's license, when the Department of Justice that made that argument in the district court here is simultaneously over in Arizona arguing that the Constitution requires them to give out driver's licenses. They're speaking out of both sides of their mouth, and I think it demonstrates how much of a shifting sand foundation for their arguments there is. The president has exceeded his authority here. It's obvious to anybody that understands the basic structure of separation of powers. And then finally, the notion that the Immigration and Nationality Act has already given the Attorney General or the Secretary of Homeland Security the discretion to do this leads me to ask the question, so why have administrations of both parties that support a change in immigration laws on this very point been fighting so hard to get the DREAM Act or something else through Congress over the last decade and a half? It's because nobody believes that there's a couple of words in one provision of the statute has the meaning that the president and his lawyers have put into it now. Because if that meaning were true, two things happen. The large portions of the other parts of the Immigration and Naturalization Act are entirely superfluous. Very carefully wrought, well-defined entitlement to statutory exemptions from deportation and eligibility for work authorization. If you're here facilitating a criminal investigation of human trafficking, for example, a very specific criteria of who is eligible, all of that goes out the window if the Attorney General just on his own or the Secretary of Homeland Security just on his own gets to issue those work authorizations whenever they want. And two, if those four words that they're relying on actually do mean that, there is absolutely no intelligible principle to guide the exercise of that discretion, and that violates the non-delegation doctrine, even if it, in its moribund form of current court precedent. Because the court has always said, when we delegate lawmaking power to the agencies, there at least has to be some intelligible principle defined by Congress, because that's where the font of lawmaking power is and must remain. And if there is no intelligible principle, as the president's interpretation of those four words amount to here, then it's unconstitutional for that reason as well. And so there's lots of stuff here, juicy stuff to get into in the Fifth Circuit and at the Supreme Court. And I'm fairly confident that they're going to hold that the president has exceeded his authority here, just like they've held that he's exceeded his authority on recess appointments a couple terms ago and a number of other instances. But this is starting to be a real threat to separation of powers, and it's particularly important that they weigh in here.
All right. We've got some audience questions. Let's turn now to our audience for the first question of the day.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. We seem to have here a great case for drawing a line between proper discretion and improper discretion. But the problem seems to be in announcing a policy publicly, because that changes the expectations that people will have as to what they can get away with, and may give rise to a legal defense against deportation when it occurs. And we have the additional problem that for what Congress is trying to do to put pressure on the DHS to not pursue this policy, since it costs money to deport and does not cost money not to deport, it seems to be futile to cut funds to the DHS for not deporting people, when in fact most of the benefits that would come to those not deported come from other agencies.
Who wants to respond?
I'm sorry. If somebody could repeat the question. He faded out there at the end on my end for a moment.
I don't think there was a question so much as a comment, maybe about the futility of trying to rein DHS in through the appropriations process, since what's required of them here is to not deport, which does not require money.
Well, no, but it does require money, because they are ramping up with thousands of new people to process these millions of applications for deferred action status. So there is an expenditure of funds, and a congressional rider on appropriation bill barring the expenditure of funds for this illegal conduct would be perfectly within Congress's power of the purse, which serves as a important check on the abuse of power in the executive. There's certainly a constitutional route. The question is, in the politics in Washington, with the Democrats doing the filibuster, can you get it through? And quite frankly, look, let's be real clear. The Senate did not try to get it through because they did not say, if you continue to filibuster this, we're gonna remove the filibuster over this issue, just as you removed the filibuster over judicial confirmations back earlier in the administration. That would have been a card that could and should have been played to weigh in with Congress making a very strong stance against the illegality of what the president is doing here, and not becoming complicit in it by agreeing to fund it, which they have now done. So, there were tools that were available. They were not exercised to their full potential, and I hope that the Senate will revisit that issue at the earliest opportunity.
Rhian Gorod, do you have a comment here?
Yeah, well, I'll address the first part of the questioner's comment, which I think dealt with the fact that these policies have been articulated in written guidance as opposed to, just exercised on the ground without being announced. And I think that if you believe that the federal government, the executive branch, can set priorities for immigration enforcement and can then exercise discretion, there's really clearly nothing wrong with articulating guidelines for the exercise discretion. I mean, if anything, I think we are much better off in a world in which the president can articulate those policies so that everyone knows what is going on, and so that officers in the field know very clearly how they should, what our national priorities are and what guidance they should follow in exercising discretion on the field. So I don't think there's any particular problem. There's certainly no precedent, no reason to think that there's anything particularly problematic about announcing these guidelines if you think the guidelines themselves and the exercise of discretion itself is okay.
Very good. A reminder, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Also, this is a special abbreviated version of Teleform, so we'll be adjourning this call in about 10 minutes. Let's take another call. Yeah, hi. I'm wondering if there has been any investigation into kind of the factual background or factual premise behind the entire enforcement priority scheme. Meaning, has anyone looked into whether or not the DHS really can deport only 400,000 people, and whether or not, for example,
you know, if you do the priority, the criminals, the terrorists, and so on, the national security threats, does that really total up to 400,000? Are there, for example, detention centers in Texas, Florida, wherever it may be, that, you know, filled up with, or are maybe only half full with the priority people, and would have plenty of room and resources to do any to do further removals?
Yeah, this
I'm not
is John. I don't know the answer on how many in the so-called priority removals and whether it hits the 400,000 or whether that's even a valid number. I will say this. The notion that only the only path toward deportation is a formal one instituted through removal proceedings really, really misunderstands the way this stuff works on the ground. If the law is being vigorously enforced, a lot of people not put into deportation voluntarily self-deport to avoid the criminal process or the deportation process or whatever the two they happen to fall into. The same thing would be true if we enforce the other side of this big magnet for illegal immigration, which is the employment side. If you go after a couple of high-profile employers, most of the other employers will get the message and will quit hiring. And so you don't have to look at how much budget there is for prosecution employers and say, we've only got the capacity to prosecute 1% of these, and therefore we ought to give up the ghost. If that were true, we'd give up the IRS enforcement system as well. So I think it's a phony argument that's been made about that 400,000 number.
Well, I mean, I'll just say, you know, I don't know specifically whether there's been investigations, you say, but I'm not aware of anyone really contesting these figures, and certainly contesting the idea that there is a sharp disconnect between available resources and the number of undocumented immigrants. I think everyone agrees that there are far fewer resources than would be necessary to deport everyone, and the question then is, what do we do about it? And, you know, as I said, I think the administration's determination that these are priorities, these have long been the priorities of the federal government in immigration enforcement, and this is one way to, in light of limited resources, facilitate execution of the priorities, makes eminent sense and is completely lawful.
We've got one question pending with about 8 or 9 minutes left. If you've got a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Hello, this is David Tryon in Cleveland. So it's interesting to me that the discussion suggests that a final decision has already been made at the trial court, which in fact it hasn't. As was observed early, this is just a preliminary injunction. And so the trial court still doesn't make a final decision, so any reversal at the Court of Appeals is just as to the preliminary injunction. And I guess I have maybe two questions here. So, Brianne, I'm just interested. The court says the court agrees that without a preliminary injunction, any subsequent ruling that finds DAPA unlawful after it is implemented would result in the states facing the substantially difficult, if not impossible, task of retracting any benefits or licenses already provided to DAPA beneficiaries. And I'm wondering if you would agree that, given that, if you agree with that, first of all, and second of all, if you do, then wouldn't it be appropriate for the preliminary injunction to stay in place until the case is finally decided at the trial court, and then that will surely be appealed to whatever it finally decides on the merits?
You know, I think I don't agree with that. I mean, I think it's in the very nature of these sorts of programs, which are actually fairly common, that, you know, they obviously can be terminated at any time. And so that same principle would apply here. If it went into force and were found to be unlawful, it would, you know, end at that time. I think, though, that the real reason why a preliminary injunction isn't appropriate here is because when you look at the factors that one considers in determining whether a preliminary injunction is appropriate, particularly likelihood of success in the merits, there is very little chance that the states at the end of the day will prevail on either their APA or their constitutional claim, and so a preliminary injunction isn't appropriate. But you're certainly right that is the stage that we're at. I think, given what the district court judge has already said, I think there's probably little doubt about what this judge is going to do, and so what at the end of the day happens is going to be in the hands of the judges of the Fifth Circuit and potentially the justices at the Supreme Court.
John Eastman, you want to respond here?
Yeah. Look, I do think there is some irretrievable stuff that will happen. The work authorizations, are you then going to cancel the work authorizations, particularly after earned income tax credits have been paid out? Are you going to recoup them? If the president's actions are viewed as unlawful, will you even try to recoup them? And if you do try, what are the likelihood of being able to pull that off? And we're talking about billions of dollars at stake here at the federal level, not to mention the processing fees of processing the driver's license, which runs to the millions or tens of millions in Texas alone. We multiply that by the 26 states that are challenging this. There are some significant costs that will be incurred by the states for implementing or being on the receiving end of the implementation of this of these actions. And if they are illegal and unconstitutional actions, as I think Brianna recognized, Judge Hannon's order strongly suggests, although I agree that at this point the order is limited to a formal holding about the Administrative Procedures Act, but the rest of the language of the opinion strongly suggests that the president has exceeded his authority here, both on the scope of the discretion, not just setting priorities, but actually setting qualification criteria for who's eligible not to be prosecuted. Those are different things. And then going beyond that with actually giving out lawful documentation, work authorization that quite frankly violate the explicit prohibitions in federal statutory law.
You know, if I'm not preempting somebody else's time, I'd like to ask one other question, and that would be, since the judge specifically said that the opinion is based on the APA, do either one of you anticipate that when the trial court reaches the merits, that it will address the constitutional question, which you've both talked about a fair amount?
Any quick responses, and then we need to adjourn, John.
Yeah, and if I were the federal government here, I would be teeing up my APA notices to go through those hoops to take the APA issue off the table, and then the courts will have to confront directly the statutory and constitutional questions that are at issue. They may not want to do that. They may want to keep this riding on APA, but we'll see what happens on that score. It does take a while to go through that APA process, and that may be longer than this litigation is going to last, but if it's at least in process, that might give them some additional argument there. But quite frankly, I would prefer the court to be looking at the constitutional issues, because I think they're serious, they're important, and they're becoming part of a pattern of lawmaking by executive pen that I think ill-serves our separation of powers.
Let me give each of our speakers a true 60 seconds for a final thought. Rand Gorod?
Sure. Well, I mean, as I've said, I think that these DHS directives are paradigmatic exercises of prosecutorial discretion. The government has articulated our national priorities in national security and public safety and border security. These are priorities that no one contests, not the states, not the district court judge. And all the DAPA directive does is provide guidance to officials on the field, officers in the field, about how best to enforce the law consistent with those priorities. This is something that executive branch has done in the past, these kind of deferred action programs. Congress has recognized them, the Supreme Court has recognized them, and there is nothing unlawful about it, and I feel confident that's what the courts will ultimately decide. Thanks.
You're welcome. John Eastman, final thought.
So the opposite 60 seconds is this takes the exercise of prosecutorial discretion to new heights. And it really does push the limit on the possibility there, because it is categorical in its nature. And the court, and every time it's recognized prosecutorial discretion, has said there is a line there, and if you cross it, now you're undermining your obligation to take care that the law be faithfully executed. I think that line has clearly been crossed here. But even if it isn't, the next step of giving lawful status, lawful presence, lawful work authorization, and Social Security cards and driver's licenses that are directly in contrary to the express statutory prohibitions that are in the law is not any exercise of prosecutorial discretion whatsoever. And at the very least, that step of these programs is unconstitutional. And I am fully confident that both the Fifth Circuit and the Supreme Court, when it gets to that issue, is going to agree and curtail the president's exercise of lawmaking power that is vested in Congress under our Constitution, not under Article 2 to the executive, the President of the United States. And thanks, Federal Society, for allowing me to participate in this very interesting call.
Well, the Federalist Society thanks both of you. This is a story that will continue to unfold. I'd welcome you both back. This has been a great discussion. There'll be more to discuss as the case moves along, perhaps up and down the circuit to the Supreme Court. In any event, my thanks to both of you today. I also want to thank our audience for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder to the audience about our next scheduled Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. when we'll be talking about campaign contribution limits, labor unions, and businesses. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.